Now, therefore, it is crucial not only in our artistic life, but in our religious life, to purify our emotions. And you know, what is sentimentality? It's not too strong a response to an object. It is a totally distorted response to an object, because all of a sudden, you are so happy about the fact that there's something going on in you that you fall in love with your own feelings and you nurse it with passion and you forget the object. Or rather, the object that has elicited this feeling becomes a mere means for the sort of experience that you're having down there. You find this in romanticism, bad romanticism. Some romantic poets are so concerned about their emotions that they no longer care a moment for the object that has triggered these emotions. It becomes absolute subjectivism and self-centeredness. You know, for example, you read this in certain poems of the 19th century, when you see that the poet is constantly nursing his Weltschmerz. You know, the world is so infinitely sad and so on and so on, and he sucks it with delight because everything is so sad and he feels so deep and so profound about this universal sadness. But he doesn't care about the tragedy which is happening in the world. This is why it's possible for someone to be deeply sentimental and incredibly hard-hearted. You know, these people are not going to lift a finger to help someone in need, but they just love the feeling everything is sad and everything is terrible and so on and so on. Sentimentality, and which is a curse and something that lies in each and every one of us. Unless you watch out, you're going to respond with tears to sentimental music and to sentimental poems and so on and so on. And this appeal to something, a center in us, which is distorted, which you become the center of the universe. And therefore, my response should always be directed to the object. And the object is what matters. What is Christian? What is a Christian message? The predominance of the heart over everything else, provided that your heart is purified. If you want to meditate on the greatness of Catholic affectivity, read the Litany of the Sacred Heart. Meditate on Christ's passion, and you're going to see that again and again, this incredibly noble notion of affectivity is going to be in the foreground. You see, because feelings are so difficult to purify, you know, we tend to look down upon them. But don't you forget that it is just as difficult to purify my mind. And it was Kierkegaard who said, the sins of the man be still worse than the sins of the heart, which are bad enough. And what is a sin of the mind? Pride. Pride that you know best, that you don't need to subject yourself to truth, that you prefer yourself to truth, as Plato said, that you are the ultimate judge of right and wrong and good and evil. That is temptation. You know, the original sin, I mean, temptation was, you know good and evil. You don't need God. You're going to be like God because you know it. It was a sin of pride. They might be excuses for sins of the heart because, after all, some might be sins of weaknesses. Whereas intellectual mistakes are usually sins of a disgusting tendency in us, which is pride. Now, of course, sentimentality, whether it is in poems, whether it is in music, when all of a sudden you have a feeling that someone is massaging your heart until tears gush down your face and you know you feel so terribly moved, and in fact you're just moved about yourself, you're just crying over yourself. You see, one of the most fascinating things is to study tears, because they're despicable tears. They're sentimental tears. They're tears of hatred. I recall my brother when he was in high school and he had one major enemy, and I don't know this enemy, was one of his teachers, as a matter of fact, humiliated him publicly. And he cried. He was sobbing. And he did not feel that he was unmanly because he was sobbing, but I mean, they were not the more the sublime tears. But then you take Christ, the God-man, the most perfect being, God. And then he sees Jerusalem, and he starts crying. And says, "Oh Jerusalem, Jerusalem, had you known the day of your visitation, and now you're going to be destroyed because you didn't recognize that your Savior had come to you." He's told that Lazarus has died. And he cries. And he knows that he's going to raise him from the dead. Why? Because he wants to show to us the nobility of the heart, responding, "No, don't tell me that the tears of Christ were sentimental cries." It was the very opposite of it. So you see, what people do is they detest sentimentality, and they're right in doing so. Let us fight sentimental art in poetry, in music, in painting, and unfortunately, I have to say, religious paintings. You know, if you go to some convents, I mean, I go to one place and every time I say, "My God, give me the gift of blindness as long as I stay here." Because it's so abominable, it's so tasteless, it is so sentimental, and so on and so on. You see, and you have this magnificent Christian art. And then all of a sudden we produce this wishy-washy, sugary, sentimental art, and then it moves people to tears because they see the Holy Virgin, you know, in tears and then holding a handkerchief and I don't know what. At any rate, just to show to you, it is detestable. But then comes a wrong response. And what is a wrong response? There are two wrong responses, because it's so easy for us to go from one stupidity to another stupidity. The difficulty is to find truth. But I mean, it's amazing how people, you know, they become, they deny the existence of matter because they have met a materialist and that everything is mind. Or the other one is going to say, "Well, you know, everything is matter." And it's neither nor, it's both. Now, there are two wrong responses to sentimentality, and one of them is a form of art that was developed at the turn of the century called the New Functionalism. My husband wrote an article about that, which I have translated, and was published in the New Tower of Babel. Sophia reprinted it. And what is interesting is that New Functionalism says art has to be absolutely neutral, because the purpose, let us say, of architecture, and it found its keenest expression in architecture, is use, pragmatism, what is healthy. For example, the main thing is when you build a house is that you have plenty of bathrooms and that you have large windows, as opposed to these depressing medieval places when you have a small little window and they're very uncomfortable and unhealthy. Therefore, good architecture is healthy architecture. And this is what we are doing today, you see. You enter an abominable little place, but you're going to have a bathroom. Whereas, you know, I recall my coming to the United States years ago, and my uncle had a secretary, and she started denigrating Europe and said, "I would care to live there. They haven't got enough bathrooms." To which, I mean, I shyly sort of hinted at the fact that maybe we have a few things that are better than bathrooms. But it is quite true. I mean, you know, it is quite true that if you go to Vienna and you see the palace of the king and you go to room after room after room after room that are magnificent, you're not going to find a toilet. And sometimes you find out that you had to go way down in the garden, you know, to satisfy certain needs of human nature. You see, but because that was for them depressing, I mean, after all, architecture has to be beautiful. Now, you can't say what you mean. A toilet can be comfortable, but don't tell me it's magnificent. You know, that all of a sudden you are moved to tears because of the beauty of this toilet. And I know some toilets that are very luxurious, but I have not met one as yet that moves me to tears. You know, even though I'm grateful for them and appreciate them. You know, just to say, "No, please do show me a beautiful computer." I even claim that it's impossible to find a beautiful car. It can be luxurious, it can be elegant, but beautiful in the sense of something that moves you to tears, no. And therefore I see in the world in which we live, we're eliminating beauty. You know, there's a war on beauty. The less beauty, the better, because now we've become practical and so on. So I say, this wrong response to sentimentality, these people are sentiment and are gushing with emotions, at least we are objective. Well, this is nonsense. And the other one, which my husband detested particularly, was false virility. And false virility is linked to the idea that if you deserve to be called a human being, you never shed tears. You're above it. What I call the macho complex. You see, you're going to find out one of the peculiarities of women is that they cry a lot more than men. Now, men would look down and say, you know, these women, they, I mean, I live with a darling friend, and I was always carrying a box of Kleenex. Because whatever happened, you know, it could be a small thing, it could be a big thing, she was always in tears. And I loved her dearly, but I mean, you know, I could not go along. Because I cannot cry from morning to night. I mean, I cry, but I mean, there are moments when you simply turn to something else, she cried her eyes off. At any rate, simply say the whole question is, women cry more than men. Is it a reason for men to look down upon them as being cry babies and sissies and the rest of you? You know, these women, they always cry. You know, I heard boys aged 12 or 13 and saying, I can't play with a girl, she always cries if you hit her. Well, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, if you are hit badly by someone who is brutal, I mean, you know, crying is fairly normal. But the whole question is, what do women cry for? And if they cry because they are sentimental, because they are self-centered, because they are stupid and limited, fine. But Virgil says in the Aeneid, sunt lacrimae rerum. There are things that call for tears. And if you lose a baby and you do not cry, there's something the matter with you. You know, there are things that call for tears. And simply say, well, I'm a man, I'm not going to cry. Well, maybe you're all dried up, you see. Maybe one of the missions that women have towards men is to irrigate deserts. Well, I mean, some of them truly need it, you see, very, very badly, simply to move, whereas what men have to do towards women is to cut down jungle. Because, I mean, they have so many feelings and so many intuitions and things and that must be cut down. And this is why the relationship between man and woman is so essential in our spiritual life. And this is why, if you say that one of the arguments used against celibacy of priests and simply say, you know, men, of course, need women because, I mean, a man is going to become an intellectual cripple if he doesn't have the feminine influence, so he's not fecundated if he doesn't find his Beatrice. Because, I mean, Beatrice, after all, fecundated Dante. I mean, what she gave him was minimal, but, I mean, the Divine Comedy is tremendous. But then, of course, you have the revenge on the other side. What a husband gives his wife is so small that you cannot see it under a microscope, and then 9 months afterwards, she gives him back a human being. So you see, it works both ways. But the whole question is, we must educate our heart. And this can only be done if we realize that this macho complex, and to believe that you're a great person if you never cry and you're above feeling and so on and so on. The whole question is, what sort of feelings? Are they sentimental feelings? Are they self-centered feelings? Are they ugly feelings? Or are they a response to an object calling for an affective response? You see, therefore, this is one of the things that he shows. Therefore, the conclusion is, if a work of art is sentimental, to the extent that it is sentimental, it is bad art. Keep off. To the extent that it is so neutral, that it totally eliminates, I mean, like a fool that I heard of when I was, I believe, in high school, who had decided that literature had to become objective. And so he wrote a book, I've forgotten his name, thank God, in which he suggested that every single time you speak about a certain water, you replace it by a chemical formula. And therefore, say, for example, I drank a glass of H2O. And then he says, no, truly, that this is objective. You see, when you say water already opens up the possibility of sentimentality and God knows what, but I mean, this is truly real and serious. Or when you speak about a sunset, you speak about gases, you know, hydrogen and oxygen and so on and so on, and they mix up together. You know, can you imagine this type of stupidity? And the world in which we live is a world in which, I mean, a sort of artistic desert That's where we live right now. And we have to strive and understand beauty has a mission in human life. Beauty has an elevating effect. Beauty spiritualizes us, and ultimately every beauty is a faint reflection of the infinite beauty of God himself. Now, therefore, this is one of the things that he eliminates. If you find sentimentality, if you find neutrality, if you find false virility, to the extent that these works are marked by it, they're bad. We have to reject them. Now, let me briefly turn to another one, which is, of course, another phenomenon which is so widespread in our society, mediocrity. Kierkegaard said about Protestantism in Denmark in the 19th century, as far as mediocrity goes, we are blessed beyond words in Protestantism. That's Kierkegaard, and don't forget he was a Protestant. No, the disease has invaded us. And you see this in religious services, and you see this in all sorts of things, mediocrity. How does my husband characterize mediocrity? The mediocre person does not oppose values. He doesn't oppose truth. He does not oppose greatness. But he waters it down. In other words, you see, he doesn't want the confrontation between himself and truth, or between himself and beauty, or between himself and greatness. And so what he tries to do is to drag it down on a level which is acceptable. You know, for example, I heard that in Hunter so many times, of course, we are on the side of truth, but don't be fanatical about it. You see, don't exaggerate. I mean, truth is basically an exaggeration. You know, you go too far. So, I mean, therefore, of course I'm all for truth. Of course they're all for beauty, but up to a point. Don't exaggerate, don't go to extremes. No, I grant you totally that Aristotle's famous mesotes, saying that virtue is between two extremes. You know, on the one hand you have, let us say, greed, and the other hand you eat too little. In order to be healthy, you have to come to the middle. And therefore, the whole question is to find the right medium, the golden mean. Now, as my husband remarked, this applies beautifully to the physical sphere. You know, you shouldn't sleep too much and you shouldn't sleep too little. You shouldn't eat too much and you should eat too little, and so on and so on. But then simply say, I want to love God. But not too much, you see. The question is, do not exaggerate. I mean, it's all very well. I go to church on Sunday, and I go to confession once a year, and, you know, this is what the church... But the idea of becoming a Carthusian or a poor Claire, no, look. These people, they exaggerate. I mean, they go overboard. But obviously, you know, all for truth and all for goodness and all for beauty, but let us water it down. This is what my husband used to call the insurance company mentality. Because whatever happens, you win. And when I found out that my insurance company is insured, you see, in other words, you never lose. You see, and therefore you see that in politics, and my husband writes this very eloquently in his, you know, the 5,000-page letter that he addressed to me to share his life with me. When he speaks about Nazi Germany, he said that first people disliked Hitler. You know, he was not that attractive. But then more powerful he became, then people said, you know, he has some good points. And then when he came to power, he said, you know, of course we don't like him, but there are certain things that he has accomplished that after all we have to endorse. But you see, simultaneously, they never committed themselves to Nazism to such an extent that if Hitler lost the war, they'll be on the wrong side of the fence. So the whole question is what I call the good politician. You don't compromise yourself. You always are so careful that whatever happens, you're going to win. And this is mediocrity. Now, of course, you find mediocrity in art. You find mediocrity in painting. You find it in music. You find it all over. And obviously, the question is to reject or to oppose this mediocrity. Mediocrity is a disease which is in all of us. And the very moment that you believe that you are not threatened by mediocrity, that's a very mediocre appreciation of human nature. We are threatened by it. I mean, there are moments when we feel like making compromises because we don't want to put our head on the block. Don't expect people to be heroes. Most of them are just going to say, well, I'm going to play safely so that nothing is going to happen to me. Now, I recall that once my husband, you know, when he had no money at all and he wanted to see Europe, and then he took a group of American students, and of course one of the main things that we visited was Florence, his hometown. And I recalled that we went to the Medici tomb in San Lorenzo. I mean, one of the most gigantic works of Michelangelo. You know, it's overwhelming, simply. It's fantastic. And one of the students was there and says, oh, how nice. And I thought my husband was going to have a heart attack. You know, just imagine this gigantic, or the ninth of Beethoven, the Passion According to St. Matthew, you see, how nice. You know, this is an artistic sin. You know, because nice means, you know, comfortable and jolly and so on and so on, you know. Whereas, I mean, you have to be awestruck by the greatness of this work, which is a work of genius. But the very moment that you say nice, then obviously this is the most typical mediocre response that you can possibly give. These people are going to say that they love St. Francis because he was singing French songs in the Umbrian hills. But of course, the very moment that he decided practically to starve himself, or they say, then, you know, then that's it's going a bit too far. Now the question is, don't exaggerate, up to a point. You know, that is a key word, up to a point. You follow God up to a point, but you don't follow him to Golgotha. In other words, you always cut things down to a lower denominator. Now, of course, once again, you're going to have reactions because mediocrity is depressing. And you know, at times you just feel that you're going to choke if you live in an atmosphere which is so mediocre that everything is petty and small and nice and comfortable. And then comes the false reaction. And you find this false reaction in rebellious revolutionary art. That say, we want none of this mediocrity, we want none of this wishy-washy. What we want is to be Prometheus, to rebel, to oppose, to destroy. You know, which of course you find in Nietzsche. You know, Nietzsche was certainly a very talented man and a very intelligent man, and he hated mediocrity. And his answer to mediocrity was to tear everything apart and to tear down and then say, well, this is great. You know, there's a poem of his in German who says, I'm fire, and whatever I touch turns to ashes. And then somehow he felt, you know, that was greatness. Or it was a Prometheus in Nietzsche who writes in Thus Speaks Zarathustra, and thinking about God's existence, and he says, if there was a God, how could I stand not to be God? Therefore, he doesn't exist. That's what I call a powerful logical reasoning. I don't want him to exist. I rebel. You know, just the idea that there's someone who is infinitely great and powerful above me. No, therefore he cannot exist because my pride cannot accept his existence. You know, this is what is so typical of this rebellious attitude, that you tear everything down. It takes another expression in Nietzsche, and of course you find this phenomenon in philosophy, but then they're translated into art. That is going to say, what is a moral law? What people call the moral law is simply the victory of the stronger over the... No. The stronger, because he's a superman, because he's more talented, has a right to dictate the law, has a right to decide, I have a right to take so and so because I'm strong and you are weak, and therefore you should not defend yourself because you're nothing and I'm great. And you'd be amazed how many people believe themselves to be supermen. You know, after reading Nietzsche, and suddenly they discover they too are supermen, and therefore they have a right to break the moral law because the moral law is the invention of the weak to protect themselves against the strong. And therefore, you see, if you take my property, you're dishonest. If you steal my wife, you're an adulterer. He says these are mere conventions. All this should be thrown to the wind, because the very moment that you're a Superman, you're above the moral law. You can destroy it. It doesn't matter. And of course, you find the same quality in art, this sort of destruction of form, this sort of joy at destroying and then feeling powerful because one destroys. You know, that was, to my mind, the terrible thing which happened when we discovered the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb. Man cannot create. He can co-create in procreation, but obviously let us not forget that it is God and God alone who creates the soul. It has nothing to do with the father, nothing to do with the mother. It is a creation of God. And man cannot create. Like this student says, I cannot make the moon. I never forgot that. I still know his name and I still see his face, you know, illumined by the moon. I cannot. This is something I cannot forgive. I mean, there's something fearful in it. But simultaneously, now we have the power to destroy. And we can say, by using a bomb, I'll press on this button, and the world goes to pieces. So if I cannot say be, and the world exists, I can say not be, and the world is gone. And that is the temptation existing today. You know, I do not exclude the possibility that some madman who believes himself to be an unknown and unrecognized genius suddenly decides to blow up New York City. You know, you can make a small atomic bomb in a basement if you know how to do it, you see, and then one very fine day where you're just offended because you haven't been promoted, and then you blow up the whole thing. And therefore, you see, this is man's rebellion against God. I cannot create, but I can destroy, and I will destroy. And you find this in art, this rebelliousness, this Prometheus sort of saying, I don't want, I'm going to oppose you because you're superior to me. Or there's another wrong reaction, response to mediocrity, which you can find, unfortunately, in some great writers. You can draw a cheap idealism. Now, the idealist loses sight of a concrete reality, and is only concerned about things that are sublime and magnificent over there, and so therefore become great Gnostics. Gnostics in the sense of despising the body, despising the humble reality of everyday life, because, I mean, after all, you can say what you please, but you cannot escape from certain humble duties that must be performed every single day. You are bound to it. I mean, just think, you're a young mother. You realize the number of hours that you'll have to spend cleaning the behind of your little child. Hours and hours. No, I cannot say that it's a sublime work, but nevertheless, it is not only a work of love, because if the child is never cleaned up, he's heading for big problems. And number two, it is a work which is highly necessary. Whereas I claim that most of the work that we do on computers and offices is perfectly unnecessary. You know, Chesterton says that much of the work which is invented in offices is simply to keep people busy so that they can have a paycheck. But basically, he hadn't been done. I mean, the world would not turn around. Whereas to clean a child's behind is an absolute necessity. It's a humble one. But God keeps reminding us that we are bound to a body. We are not pure angels. And in idealism, you see, people, there's a German poet who said once, Goethe walked, and walking is one of the noblest way of going from one place to another, because God has given us two legs. This has been forgotten in the United States, and then, you know, when I first came over, and everybody was using a car to cross a street, and I was absolutely amazed, and I said, well, these people are mad. I mean, after all, what about their legs? And then after 25 years, they discovered that it was very unhealthy. And then they had to invent machines in which they walk, you see, because they would dream of walking on the street. So you have to have a machine and you exercise, and you, which is, to my mind, the most depressing thing that you can imagine, walk. But I mean, why do you have to have a machine to walk? Now, and this man said, Goethe walked. Schiller, the famous poet Schiller, says, was riding Pegasus. you know, going to high sky and so on and escaping. And the poet, who's called Demel, very insignificant man, he says, I go on bicycle. Now you see the tremendous difference between them. To walk is poetic. To ride Pegasus has its danger because you're escaping from reality and simply say, I only live for sublime and spiritual things. You see, don't drag me down to everyday, you know, the question of doing homework or these are so depressing. I mean, I'm concerned about great things and noble things. And he's on a bicycle. No, I don't want to offend Hollanders, but I mean, that is their way of moving. I mean, ever since I was a child close to Holland, I mean, everybody was on a bicycle. Now, a bicycle is good and practical and the rest of it, but don't tell me that it's an extraordinary poetic thing. Now, of course, what is the answer? If you turn to what is sentimental, the answer is true, authentic, affective response.